for Amateur Radio as a QSO Today virtual ham partner. The Federal Communications Commission has started accepting applications for a telecommunications specialist at its High Frequency Direction Finding Center in Columbia, Maryland. That center supports the FCC's over-the-air spectrum observation capabilities and provides direct support to the public safety community and other federal partners by locating interference sources.
You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Tune in on Monday, July 25th to all sorts of creative community voices on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Including at 9 a.m., we'll hear from a variety of speakers at the anti-plastic event held in Albany, July 23rd. Then at 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing new music on his Playing Favorites show live from the WGXC Hudson Studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. The Deep Three show after the noon news features Misha Molev-Abado, Alexei Burakov, and Vladimir Osachevsky, among others. 2 p.m., there's brand new music from around the world on the Vital Weekly show, including tracks this week from Nuri Veri, Darren Tate, and Jerzy Swig. Tracking the Odds is the show from Roulette Intermedium in Brooklyn at 3 p.m., and they feature composer and virtuoso pianist Denman Maroney on this month's show. Then at 8 p.m., tune in to Rob Van Erve, the Valencia resident who knows everything all the time, on the radio at 90.7 FM WGXC.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now. Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Henning's Local Test Kitchen in Round Top, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts programming on WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom, wgxc.org, for more information about any of these stories. Larry Rullison reports for the Times Union that the State Department of Conservation says a mysterious disease is killing beech trees in 35 counties in New York. Beech leaf disease first appeared in western New York in 2018 and later on Long Island and Westchester County. The DEC says now the same disease made it to East Herkimer County this year, bringing it relatively close to the capital region. Beech leaf disease currently has no cure. The disease can kill a mature tree in 6 to 10 years and saplings within 2 years. It's believed to be associated with small worms called nematodes that feed on beech leaves and buds. Scientists are not sure if the worms cause the damage that kills the trees or something else is responsible, such as a virus, bacteria, or a fungus. Quote, many American beech trees are already heavily impacted by beech bark disease, unquote, DEC Commissioner Basil Sago said in a statement. Quote, but beech leaf disease appears to be an even bigger threat, unquote. Sago said that the new disease will have an impact on both forest and on city and suburban streets where Cooper beech trees are extremely popular for commercial and residential landscaping and to line streets. The decline of the beech tree could have far-reaching consequences, the commissioner said. DEC is asking that if the public notices the disease on beech trees in their location, they report it online at newyorkimapinvasives.org. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Bill Williams reports for Columbia Green Media that the town of Ankrum is newly certified as a bronze-level climate-smart community, one of 6 statewide. Ankrum received its certification in part by installing solar panels and an electric vehicle charging station at Town Hall and increasing access to renewable energy for residents and local businesses by streamlining and permitting process for rooftop solar and running a community solar campaign, according to a statement by the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Ankrum Town Supervisor Art Basson said officials have been working on this project for 10 years. He said the process began with the town board passing a resolution, and then a climate smart task force was formed to come up with and implement the items needed for this certification. The solar panels mounted on the roof of Town Hall were paid for by a grant from New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. The electric vehicle charging station was donated by Ginico Electric. The Ankrum Community Solar Campaign is open to all town residents, where everyone is eligible for a 10% discount on the cost of the project, Basson said. Established in 2009, the Interagency Climate Smart Communities Program provides guidance and technical support to local governments to take locally driven climate action. The first step to becoming a climate smart community is to register by pledging to reduce emissions and adapt to climate change. To date, 356 local governments have adopted the Climate Smart Communities Pledge. There are now a total of 94 certified Climate Smart Communities statewide, 9 silver and 85 bronze. Read more about the story at HudsonValley360.com. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup. The Caro Town Board will conduct a public hearing July 20th on a proposal to apply for a community development block grant to fund the conversion of the former American Dojo Martial Arts and Fitness Center on State Route 32 into a senior and community center. Town officials purchased the 8,000-square-foot structure along with 2 acres of land in late 2021 for $399,000. The plan is to use the space as a senior and community hub and replace the current Acre Senior Center. There would be a space in the rear of the building for town ambulances, quoted, so we can get rid of the mess that is over in Acre, unquote, said Town Supervisor Jason Watts. The new senior center, Watts said, would offer a meeting place for seniors as well as a new kitchen for Greene County's senior meal program. The Acre Senior Center and property would then be sold in approximately 2 years. The Community Development Block Grant is offered through the New York State Office of Community Renewal. Grant applications for the Senior Center project are being prepared by Barton & Lugis, an Albany-based engineering firm. The public hearing will be held at Town Hall and is scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. Read more at porcupinesoup.com. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day 50,000 lumber workers across the Pacific Northwest participated in an industry-wide strike called by the Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW had been organizing loggers for years around wages, hours, working conditions, and camp sanitation. The IWW began building for the strike in the aftermath of the Everett Massacre the previous fall. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn started touring camps in Idaho. By March, the Wobblies established Local 500 of the Lumber Workers Industrial Union in Spokane to organize across the region. In his book, Emperor of Timber, historian Eric Loomis details the chronology of events that led to the momentous walkout. In Idaho, loggers began walking off the job in April when demands for improved bunkhouses and food, higher wages, and the 8-hour day were refused. The strike spread to Washington State, the rest of Idaho, and into Montana and Oregon. Loomis notes that by August, they made employers feel their wrath. The strike cut production by over 80% and threatened war material. Infuriated timber bosses demanded federal troops be sent in to crush the strike and IWW leaders be prosecuted for treason and sabotage. Raids and arrests were orchestrated throughout the Pacific Northwest, and the strike began to stall. After 10 weeks, the IWW called off the strike, but instructed workers to quit work after 8 hours. They continued to lead sanitation-related job actions that would substantially change conditions for the better.
50,000 lumberjacks, 50,000 packs, 50,000 dirty rolls of blankets on their backs, 50,000 minds made up to strike and strike like men.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Of Trump, coups, and Lumumba's tooth. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
All bets are off.
Those are the words of Jason Van Tatenhoff, speaking before the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol this week.
If a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact, what else is he going to do if he gets elected again?
Van Tatenhoff, a former member of and spokesperson for the armed right-wing white supremacist militia group, the Oath Keepers, was speaking of a potential Donald Trump presidential victory in 2024. The House Select Committee has held 7 public hearings since June, with at least one to go, probing the deadly assault on the Capitol that targeted the joint session of Congress held on January 6, 2021, to formally count the Electoral College votes and declare Joe Biden the president-elect. President Donald Trump, as the committee has painstakingly documented, had been working feverishly to overturn the 2020 election results, spewing conspiracy theories, filing scores of frivolous lawsuits, threatening election officials, and mounting a relentless propaganda campaign alleging the election he lost by a landslide had been stolen. When all else failed, he summoned a mob to Washington to stop the steal. Thousands heeded Trump's invitation, then his January 6 rally speech, urging them to march on the Capitol. He knew many of them were armed. Among the thousands who mobbed the building were teams of Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and 3%er militias who'd planned and coordinated the attack.
It was like something from a medieval battle.
Those are the words of Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell, an Iraq War veteran testifying before the House Select Committee. 4 protesters died in the melee, 1 shot by police, and 3 of natural causes exacerbated by the riot. At least 150 police officers were injured, Gunnell among them. Doctors just told him he had to retire due to severity of his injuries. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick died the next day after several strokes provoked by the injuries sustained during the assault. 4 more officers subsequently died by suicide, believed directly related to January 6th. They were Officer Howard Liebengood of the Capitol Police and Officers Jeffrey Smith, Gunther Hashida, and Kyle DeFreitag of the Metropolitan Police Department. Many among those who violently attacked the Capitol that day, with no apparent irony, sported flags and clothing proclaiming their support of the Thin Blue Line, as law enforcement is often called. The House Select Committee is nearing the end of its work and has begun sharing its extensive trove of documents, depositions, testimonies, and other evidence with the U.S. Department of Justice. Whether Donald Trump faces criminal charges for inciting riot and attempting a violent coup remains to be seen. Trump could also face state charges in Georgia, where he actively attempted to coerce the Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes and thus overturn Biden's win there by one vote. Never in U.S. history has a president so openly attempted to subvert an election and the peaceful transfer of power at home. Sadly, that can't be said for U.S. involvement in other nations around the world. The United States has a long history of organizing, funding, arming, and actively perpetrating coups against democratically elected governments. Examples in the modern era include Iran in 1953 with the overthrow of the popular Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, Guatemala in 1954 by the overthrow of progressive President Jacobo Arbenz. In 1961, the U.S., along with Belgium, had Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of newly independent Republic of Congo, arrested and executed. The Belgian police commissioner took a gold-capped tooth from Lumumba's body as a trophy, after which his corpse was dismembered and dissolved in acid. Last month, Belgium returned the tooth to Lumumba's family. They're now returning it to the Democratic Republic of Congo. In 1973, the U.S. backed a military coup against Chile's democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. President Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, reportedly told Nixon at the time, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves," Kissinger said. Just this week, John Bolton, national security advisor under Trump, bragged on CNN.
That is somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah.
Not here, but, you know, other places. It takes a lot of work.
John Bolton supported the 2004 U.S.-orchestrated Haitian coup that overthrew President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and more recently advocated for toppling the governments of Iran and Venezuela. A country that mounts coups should not be so surprised when someone attempts one at home. We need a uniform standard of justice in the world, free of coups. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC renewable weather forecast for Sunday, July 17th. We start each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The lowest price, according to the Gas Buddy website, for a gallon of gasoline in Greene County is at the Stewart's Shops in Haynes Falls, where it's $4.69 a gallon right now. Next, we discover what the air quality forecast is for Sunday, July 17th, and it's 31, still in the good range. Then we look at the weather forecast from the National Weather Service in Albany, and they predict a Sunday with mostly sunny skies, but isolated showers and thunderstorms are possible after 1 p.m. There's a 20% chance. The high of 83, and a calm wind becoming south around 6 miles per hour, spinning local windmills in the afternoon. Sunday night, there's a 30% chance of scattered showers and possibly a thunderstorm, mainly after 4 a.m., with cloudy skies and a low around 66, and a south wind 3 to 5 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Monday, there's a 70% chance of rain, showers and thunderstorms possible, mostly after 2 p.m., with cloudy skies and a high of 77, and a low around 66. And then Tuesday, scattered showers and thunderstorms are possible again. There's a 30% chance, mainly in the morning. Then it turns sunny, good for the local solar panels, with a high of 85 and a low around 67. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and now we are joined on the phone by Heather Goodall, a union campaign manager trying to get the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Skodak in Rensselaer County unionized. Did I get all that right, Heather?
You did. Yep, it's Heather. Yes, absolutely. I'm the union campaign manager for the Skodak Amazon warehouse. We're very excited to be moving forward. We actually have already started our online signatures, and we're doing very well with that. So hopefully by the end of the week, at the end of the rally, we'll have our, you know, 60 to 70%.
So before we get to the specifics, I'm excited to talk to someone who's a union organizer. We hear a lot of reports that there is a lot more interest in unions these days, but you seem to have on the ground knowledge about this issue.
Yes. a little known fact, I was actually New York State Department of Finance insurance agent and a benefit advisor for two of the largest unions in the state of New York. So I do have that experience and that background. I also ran a marketing firm, which is how I discovered some of the HR challenges within the warehouse. So, yes, I do come to the table with some experience.
And so why do you think more people are interested in unions these days?
Because I think that employment practices such as Amazon have gotten away with so many state and federal violations for so long that employees are finally saying that they've had it and they've seen, you know, what the employers have done in terms of abusive employment practices. The injuries are on the rise. The other thing is the cost of living has gone up, but our wages have not. So we're not even earning a living wage. And I think employees are finally at the point where we are demanding for change, and that's not going to happen. And we need to hold these employers accountable for the, you know, the lack of wages, the lack of safety protocol, and I think workers are finally seeing strength in our numbers.
And Amazon is a good example of what one might call the problem with capitalism these days. That it's almost like we're back in the late 1800s. There's a sort of gilded age, and Amazon controls so much of the market that it is sort of gets away with a lot of stuff, it seems like. Is that a proper way to put it?
That's 100% accurate, and here's the thing. You use the word control, and that's exactly what's happened. Amazon has skillfully and tactfully controlled not only the market, but also the employees, and they are disposing of employees. So the fact that they have gotten so large so quick, it's created a sense of greed, and that greed has had complete, they've been able to dismiss the fundamental rights of workers. Because if you think about it, that control extends to consumers, and consumers, we do need Amazon, and that's the thing. You know, we had a petition that were up to 1,500 signatures in less than 2 days calling on consumers to recognize the working conditions, and the word boycott was used. And that, you know, is an interesting word because on one hand, a boycott, you know, would be fantastic in terms of getting us to be recognized. But on the other hand, there are consumers that do need Amazon to purchase specialty foods, or people that can't leave their homes. And we've seen that need grow even during the pandemic. All we're asking is that we continue to utilize the benefits of Amazon, but we are calling on them to, you're absolutely right, we don't live in the 1800s. We don't live in an era where, you know, working conditions are not recognized by state and federal law. They need to comply with those state and federal laws, and they're not doing it because they control the market and the workers.
And if we'll get now to Skodak specifically, but that facility, I believe the neighbors were very much against and have been protesting ever since the idea of building it came up.
Yes. And I do believe that relates to two major issues that I've researched. Number one is, you know, the funny thing is within the warehouse, I actually left by ambulance a week and a half ago, and I'm out for a month. And one of the symptoms I was experiencing was vertigo, and that's very common in the warehouse. And many people who know me know I got into this because I did lose my oldest son 6 years ago. He was one of several employees that worked for Global Foundries that died. So when that happened, I educated myself not only on corporate culture, but also toxic exposure. So I know one of the residents' concern is the fact that there's an increase in toxins released into the air, specifically the trucks. So I know that the releases since the warehouse has been there has been a concern. The other thing, which I'm waiting on a report now, is the increase in ambulances and EMS arrival to the warehouse. From what I understand, in less than 2 years, there's been over 100 ambulance responses. So clearly, you know, with that increase, and what's going to happen if that continues, then taxes are more than likely going to go up to accommodate volunteer firefighters, volunteer EMS. So there is some specific concerns in addition to the increase in traffic, and Amazon has been very irresponsible in that aspect.
So you're reporting that ambulance visits to the facility are over 100 a year, and what are those? Why are the ambulances going to the facility?
Okay, so in terms of reporting, I am waiting for confirmation on that specific number, so I don't want to give you, I don't want to state that as mm-hmm. a fact. Gotten that report. However, there has been conversations in the warehouse that have said, yes, there have been over 100 ambulance arrivals since it opened in September 2020, so in less than 2 years. So that being said, some of the responses, for example, dehydration, injuries, sprains, maybe not sprains, but like I went because I was very close to a heart attack, and that's why I'm out for a month. I had a heart condition. I was still placed on a piece of equipment that I shouldn't have been operating due to the medical documentation provided. But of course, as across the board with several other examples, there is medical documentation being provided that's falling on deaf ears. So people are returned to physicians, causing, I know that somebody got their finger caught in the conveyor belt, so that was one. My heart, we did have another employee that suffered a stroke in the warehouse on Thanksgiving. We have the U-boats are broken, so a U-boat is a very large piece of equipment, and because they're broken, they've caused injuries to people's shins, people's concussions, I know, is one. People are loading the ship on the ship dock. For example, yesterday it was very hot, and there's no air conditioning going into the back of the truck. So people are loading the trucks when the trucks are reaching temperatures in excess of 105 degrees. They're not given additional breaks to rehydrate, and then they get in trouble if they go to the bathroom for time off task. So people are reluctant to stay hydrated because they're not given additional breaks. So there is a variety of injuries and concerns that are being addressed that is causing the EMS arrival.
And it sounds like a sort of high-pressure operation.
High pressure is definitely an understatement. When you say high pressure, that is, I think, relating to a primary cause for injury. Because if you have people that are trained for one day, which is another opposition of mine, how can you train somebody to operate an 8,000-pound piece of equipment or even operate on a conveyor belt, when we also learned the conveyor belts have been manually modified to accommodate boxes that exceed the manufacturer's suggestion. So now that conveyor belt is operating at a rate that is non-compliant. So clearly, between the lack of training and the quota, it causes injury. People are expected, for example, to pack. I mean, I don't know how this is even possible, but for example, I'll give you a picker. So a picker, you have to get 45 items an hour. So you have this 8,000 piece of equipment that you're trained for one day. You get a list of items that you have to retrieve, and I encourage you to look at the photos that I've taken on the inside over the course of the last couple months to see the fact that not only are we expected to make these unattainable quotas, 45 an hour, loading of 200 an hour, but we're also expected to do it with collapsing bins, items falling off of shelves, broken U-boats, a modified conveyor belt, and the expectations, I mean, they're dangerously high. Dangerously is the word I want to impress upon. And once you look at the photos and you listen to that word, dangerously high expectations, that's where the injuries are mostly coming from. every day. Because if you don't attain those expectations, you will get fired. It's a fact.
And so what specifically are you guys trying to do? You're trying to